Hello and welcome back to UEG Journal Podcast, your quick dive into latest and most impactful research in gastroenterology. I'm Dr. Mohsen Subbani, Trainee Associate Editor of UEG Journal and gastroenterologist based at Nottingham, UK.
And I'm Maria Manuela Stvino, Trainee Associate Editor of the UEG Journal and a gastroenterologist based in Porto, Portugal.
And I'm pleased to say that we're back with the latest episode with a very special guest, and we welcome Dr. Keith Sal, UEG Journal Associate Editor and a consultant gastroenterologist.
Welcome on board, Keith.
Oh, thank you so much, Mohsen and Manuela. And on behalf of UEG Journal, I want to thank you for the wonderful work you're doing for UEG Journal podcast. So thanks for having me here today.
So let's begin with our first paper, which explores an important quality issue when we think about upper GI endoscopy. That's a variation in post-endoscopy upper gastrointestinal cancer, or PUGIC, rates across providers in England. So Keith, this is a really impactful national study. And do you think that you could start by explaining what PUGIC represents and why it is such an important quality indicator in our endoscopy practice?
Sure. Thanks, Manuela. So PUGIC stands for post-endoscopy upper GI cancer, as you said. This is a really important metric, which refers to an upper GI cancer diagnosed after a previously negative endoscopy, typically within the last 3 years. And this is an important patient-centered outcome because this impacts the patient, and this reflects either a missed cancer or a missed precancerous lesion. When patients undergo an endoscopy, they want to make sure that the examination has been conclusive and that we haven't missed any pathology. This metric measures the quality of the examination. The truth is, around 10% of cancers are post-endoscopy, and we know that endoscopy can be hugely variable from one endoscopist to another, and this can really affect patient outcomes. And from colonoscopy that has its own post-colonoscopy cancer metric, we know that the better the quality of endoscopy, using metrics like adenoma detection rate, the lower the post-endoscopy cancer rate.
Thanks, Keith. As you highlighted, the variation in the cancer rate post-endoscopy across different centers, could you please walk us through the study design and tell us how authors compared high versus low performing providers?
So this was a study by my close friends, Uma Kamran and Nigel Trudgill from Birmingham. They analyzed data from the UK National Endoscopy Database, and they captured nearly 330,000 diagnostic OGD procedures, gastroscopy procedures. They aimed to look at units with the best and worst missed cancer rates, so lowest versus highest PUGIC rates, to look at differences so that they could direct interventions and target areas for quality improvement. Units in the UK were ranked into quartiles based on their PUGIC rates between 2015 and 2018. The authors collected service level data and looked at different factors that could be associated with PUGIC.
Wonderful. And what were the key endoscopic characteristics that were associated with providers that had the lowest PUGIC rates, Keith?
So the overall PUGIC rate was 8.6%. So this meant that 8.6% of cancers were diagnosed in patients who had had a negative gastroscopy in the preceding 3 years. In the lowest performing centers, this was as high as 10.3% in the highest quartile. And in the best performing centers with the lowest PUGIC rates, this was down to 7.2%. So there was a range there, and there was a variation there. From the absolute lowest to highest PUGIC rates, this difference was about threefold. When the authors looked at units with the lowest PUGIC rates, which were the absolute best performing units in the UK, they found that they shared distinct features. And these included, number one, more training sessions. So the best units trained more, did more training. Secondly, endoscopists had higher annual endoscopy volumes. So over 100 procedures a year, they were doing more. Thirdly, procedures used intravenous sedation more. And these included a combination of midazolam and fentanyl. Fourth, the biopsy rates were actually lower in higher performing units. And then finally, in the best performing units, the intensity of half-day sessions were lower. So these included a point system that we have uniquely in the UK. So units with lowest Puget rates had 9 or less points per list. It's important to note that this study did not look at factors such as inspection time, endoscope quality, considering that this study included data from over 10 years ago, and patient comfort.
Great, Keith, for highlighting all this. Would you think that some of these factors you highlighted could be counterintuitive? For example, the relationship between biopsy rates and sedation. And how do you think is best to interpret these findings in everyday clinical practice?
So units that use more sedation, especially in conjunction with opioids, had lower Puget rates. And this really makes sense because it's hard to do good endoscopy when the patient is moving or trying to pull out the scope. And good sedation allows the endoscopist to take time to look properly, to clean the mucosa without any pressure. And some societies actually recommend spending an inspection time of 7 minutes or more to examine the mucosa. And this can be an awfully long time without any sedation. Regarding biopsies, it's interesting to see that endoscopists in better units took less biopsies, but they actually took more targeted biopsies when they really mattered for high-risk lesions. And I think this reflects practitioners taking on a more targeted approach rather than just a random shotgun approach. I suppose it could be a marker of better lesion recognition abilities, for instance. Endoscopy, as we know now, is a really visual sport. We should spend more time looking rather than taking biopsies.
Yes, that's very interesting, Keith. And also, this study also allows us to look for modifiable factors, right? From your perspective, what are the key takeaway messages that we should take from this study that will allow us to improve our endoscopy quality and also to reduce the amount of missed cancers?
So firstly, volume is important. We need to be doing a critical mass of volumes. And that's, according to this study, is about 100 procedures or more a year. Secondly, hospital bookings teams need to avoid packing lists with patients so that there is time to perform good quality inspection and minimize fatigue. Thirdly, training is good for patients. Training procedures benefit from an extra pair of eyes and probably greater vigilance from the trainer. And it really makes us up our game. I think units should be a bit more welcoming to trainees, and there should be more focus on optical diagnosis. Finally, we need to use that time to inspect more. Use that time to look, clean, photodocument, use near focus, optical enhancement, perhaps take a second look. And this is really important to spot precancerous lesions like gastric atrophy, Barrett's esophagus, or suspicious ulcers. Don't just take random biopsies, but take targeted biopsies. And if we're really in doubt, bring patients back for a second look. Overall, the lesson here is that a missed cancer is actually a complication of a procedure, and patients need to be consented for this and should be safety netted appropriately.
Excellent. So this all highlights the variation in technique, training, and workload, and how it can impact the risk of missing cancer in upper GI endoscopy. And interestingly, one of the key themes here is how endoscopic technique and approach can influence the detection and outcome of these procedures.
This brings up to our next paper, a randomized controlled trial comparing cold versus hot resection techniques for intermediate-sized sessile serrated lesions. So, Mosen, this is a really practical question for our everyday endoscopy. So, could you start by briefly reminding us what makes sessile serrated lesions so important?
Absolutely. So, sessile serrated lesions, or we also call them SSLs, are now recognized as an important precursor in serrated pathway to colorectal cancer, particularly for right-sided lesions. They can be quite subtle, often flat, pale and indistinct borders, which makes them very difficult to recognize and identify, and also pulpectomy make very hard in certain cases. So getting both detection and resection right in these cases is an effective way for future cancer prevention.
Yes, that's true. And in terms of resection strategy, indeed, many of us have traditionally learned that these lesions should be resected toward hot EMR. So, Keith, could you briefly outline what this trial sets out to compare?
Thanks, Manuela. So we have lots of randomized trials that compare resection techniques for adenomas, but very few for SSLs, which makes this really unique. So this was a randomized controlled trial from Taiwan by a group that called themselves the TACOS Working Group. And they set out to compare three different techniques from removing intermediate-sized sessile serrated lesions. So those that measured between 10 and 20 millimeters. The three methods compared were cold snare polypectomy, cold EMR, which is endoscopic mucosal resection, and hot EMR. The primary outcome was complete histological resection. And this is defined as having horizontal and vertical resection margins that are completely clear of tumor. Other outcomes studied include on-block resection rates, procedure time, complications, including delayed bleeding and perforation.
Thanks, Keith. So thanks for taking us through the methodology of the trial. And authors included actually intermediate-sized SSLs, so roughly between 10 up to 19 millimeters in size. Would you mind just highlighting some of the key findings from this trial?
So in total, 120 patients were randomized into each of the three groups. So we had about 40 patients per group. The mean polyp size per group was about 14 millimeters. Both cold methods were proven to be non-inferior to hot EMR. The complete histological resection rates were about 90% for each group. Cold snare polypectomy resulted in significantly shallower vertical resection depth compared to hot EMR or cold EMR. On average, this was about 0.5 millimeters clearance for cold snare versus 1 millimeter clearance for hot snare. Unsurprisingly, cold snare polypectomy led to lower on-block resection rates. This was about 70% for cold snare versus nearly 80% for cold EMR and 90% for hot EMR. However, cold snare was by far the fastest. It reduced polypectomy times by 3 minutes and total procedure times by 10 minutes compared to hot EMR. I think overall, the study provides strong evidence that supports current guidelines from the ESGE that recommend cold resection techniques for intermediate-sized SSLs, proving that they can avoid the risks of thermal injury while maintaining comparable efficacy to traditional hot snare methods.
Thank you for an amazing summary, Keith. So it looks like efficacy was quite comparable, but safety is where things may differ, right? So could you please expand on the safety outcomes reported in this study, Keith?
I think this study was underpowered to look at safety outcomes, considering that there were only 40 polyps per group. There were no perforations encountered, and there were no differences in immediate or delayed bleeding between groups. So these three methods were comparatively as safe as each other.
Great. So from practical point of view, Keith, how do you think we should be advising clinician, or how should the clinician taking findings into account while performing colonoscopy?
We finally have a three-way RCT that supports the use of cold resection techniques for intermediate-sized SSLs. It shows that the cold snare method is fast and it shaves off up to 10 minutes of the procedure time. But my concern is that it leaves a shallower resection depth and lower on-block resection rates. However, before we can conclude that these three methods are the same, we need to remember the key study limitations. The fact is, this is a small study. There was no follow-up colonoscopy data to look at post-polypectomy recurrence rates. And this is a key factor in post-colonoscopy cancer. It's also unclear whether these results can be influenced by underwater EMR methods, which most of us routinely do.
That's really interesting, Keith. And do you think there are any particular situations where you would still favor EMR over a cold approach?
Personally, for SSLs under 10 millimeters, I think cold snare will do the job. For those that are larger than 10 millimeters, I prefer cold EMR, and this is supported by this study. And I find this more reassuring because the lift better defines the borders, and you can be sure that you've removed the polyp in its entirety. Luckily, SSLs are usually softer and more superficial lesions than adenomas, and these can be removed without heat. The only exception for me that where I favor hot EMR is when there is a high-risk lesion, such as in sessile serrated polyposis syndrome, or when there is an SSL with dysplasia. And in these cases, I prefer on-block resection. Adenomas, however, they're a different beast. These are more resistant, they have higher recurrence rates, And it's really important that we ensure that when we resect them, we give them clear horizontal and vertical margins. And we should be opting for hot EMR in these cases.
This all is very interesting and shows how defining endoscopic techniques can meaningfully impact on both safety and outcomes. And also, interestingly, it also links to a broader question, how we can optimize colorectal cancer prevention strategies.
Exactly. And that brings up to our next paper, which takes a step back and looks at screening approaches more broadly, comparing colonoscopy and fecal immunochemical testing with outcomes stratified by age and sex.
This paper takes a broader view of colorectal cancer prevention. This is a post-op analysis of ClonPrev study looking at outcome of colonoscopy versus FIT testing and stratified by age and sex. Neela, could you start briefly reminding us of what original study showed and why this follow-up analysis is important?
Of course. So the original ColonPrev trial was a landmark randomized study comparing a one-time screening colonoscopy with biennial FIT in average-risk individuals aged between 50 and 69. It showed that FIT-based screening was non-inferior to colonoscopy in terms of colorectal incidence, a cancer incidence, and mortality, largely because more people participated in FIT screening, and it is important to emphasize this. What this analysis does is that it does a dig, it digs deeper, asking whether these outcomes differ depending on sex and age, which is highly relevant as we move towards more personalized screening strategies.
Thanks for summarizing it. So Keith, would you mind walking through the design of this analysis and what specific outcomes authors looked at and why they are important?
Of course. As you say, this was a post-hoc analysis of the ColonPrev study, which specifically compared FIT testing versus one-off colonoscopy. In this trial, or in this post-hoc study, the authors looked at the impact of gender and age on patient outcomes. The primary outcome was cancer mortality 10 years down the line, and the secondary outcomes include participation rates and cancer incidence.
So Keith, as you were highlighting around age and sex, so the trial included over 50,000 individuals. The most age groups were between 50 to 59 and the second group between 60 to 69. Can you take us through the key finding from the trial?
So at 10 years, the risk of colorectal cancer for men was 1.5%. And for women, this was 1%. So the risk of men being affected by post-enrollment cancer was nearly 50% higher. And because of this, men also had higher cancer-related mortality rates than women. So this was 3 in 1,000 versus 1.5 per 1,000. Unsurprisingly, patients in their 60s had higher risk of cancer outcomes than those screened in their 50s. Overall, when matched by age and gender, screening with 2 yearly FIT testing was not inferior to a one-off colonoscopy. It's worth noting that the colonoscopy group found more polyps, but this did not change 10-year mortality.
Okay, and one of the most striking aspects that we have here is the consistency of the outcomes. Mosen, what does the study tell us about how effective these two screening strategies are across different demographic groups?
So interestingly, Mariola, the both strategies performed similarly regardless of age or sex. The reduction in colorectal cancer incidence and mortality were consistent across all groups, suggesting that overall effectiveness of screening doesn't really depend on these factors. However, there were still important baseline differences. Men and older individuals had higher cancer incidence, mortality, and that was despite screening. So screening perhaps helps, but it does not completely eliminate underlying risk differences.
Yes, and participation is a key part of this story as well, of course. So Keith, what did the study show about uptake of screening between FIT and colonoscopy?
I have to say that the participation in this study and the compliance to screening was quite limited. So this was about 40% for FIT testing and 32% for colonoscopy. And the participation was slightly lower in men. And these were the population with the higher risk of cancer and higher mortality. And of course, the protective effects of colorectal cancer screening can only apply to people who turn up.
And this is a very important factor, as you highlighted, Keith. Participation across FIT was higher across based on sex and age, which would likely explain the overall effectiveness matches the colonoscopy at population level. On the other hand, colonoscopy had higher diagnostic yield for pre-malignant lesions, meaning it detects more adenomas when it is performed. So we're really looking at trade-off between uptake and sensitivity.
Yes, that's completely right. So when we look to our real-world practice, effectiveness isn't just about test performance, but whether people do engage or not with screening. Keith, how should these findings influence how we design our personalized screening programs?
That's an important question, because the engagement rate here is much lower than other countries. The highest we see is Finland with about 80% for FIT. And the runner-ups include UK and Netherlands with bowel cancer screening compliance of just over 70%. For the US, which is primarily colonoscopy-based, this level is about two-thirds. So these countries are doing a great job. Of note, Sweden uses different FIT thresholds for men and for women. The threshold there for men is 80 and then 40 for women. I think the FIT threshold used in this trial was about 15 for comparison. And these improve concordance with testing. For a bowel cancer screening program to succeed, you need a really well-oiled team. There needs to be a centralized program of mailing, and in this era, texts, emails, and possibly even social media notifications. Patients need to understand why they need the test so that they can actually adhere to that or recognize the importance of turning up. So education is really important. Reminders help, as are endorsements from GPs, and personalized human contact for non-responders.
Absolutely. So what this study suggests that we don't have to, perhaps in this age group, personalize the screening strategies just based on age or sex, but probably need to look into other factors. And maybe we need to learn from other nations where the screening programs are performing better and look at the factors in population level regarding adherence to both like screening program. And there was also a lot of learning from latest vaccination programs.
So overall, this study reinforces the message that both colonoscopy and FIT are effective, but their success, of course, depends on how they are implemented at the population level. And ultimately, of course, improving uptake may be just as important as improving our technique. So with this, we are going to move to our final paper. And now we turn to sedation, something that underpins almost every endoscopic procedure we do. So this study is a multicenter randomized controlled trial comparing remimazolam with midazolam for diagnostic upper gastrointestinal endoscopy. So Mohsen, could you start by briefly explaining us what makes remimazolam different from the sedatives we are more familiar with?
Absolutely. So remimazole is a relatively new but an ultra-short-acting benzodiazepine. Like midazolam, it works on GABA receptor, but it has much shorter half-life and is rapidly metabolized by tissue esterases. This essentially means faster onset and faster recovery, which makes it an attractive option for procedural sedations, particularly in endoscopy, where efficacy and turnovers is really important.
And Keith, could you walk us through the design of this trial, please?
Sure. So this trial involved 7 endoscopy centers in South Korea. They randomized patients undergoing routine gastroscopy to either midazolam or remimazolam. Patients were eligible if they were fit, so ASA score of 1 to 2, if they were young, so between 19 and 60, and had a BMI between 18.5 and 30. They were excluded if they needed anything more complicated done, so therapeutic endoscopy, or if they had any significant liver, kidney, or respiratory comorbidity. Patients received loading doses of either drug, and that's 5 milligrams for remimazolam and 2 milligrams for midazolam, and had regular top-ups every 2 minutes until they were moderately sedated using an MOAA score of 3 or less. You can look that up on the paper. The primary outcome was total procedure time. So that's the time from first sedation dose to discharge. The other outcomes they looked at included the time to maximal sedation, adverse events, and patient satisfaction.
Yes, thank you, Keith. And what were the main findings?
So 66 patients were involved into each group. The average dose of remimazolam was 7.5 milligrams, and for midazolam, it was 5 milligrams. Remimazolam was a clear winner here. It significantly reduced the total procedure time compared to midazolam, dropping the average time from 48.5 minutes to 30.3 minutes. Patients who had remimazolam achieved not only a deeper level of sedation, but they got to it faster too. So they got deeper sedation within 3 minutes compared to 6 minutes for midazolam, and they also recovered faster. Patients receiving remimazolam required less top-up doses, and 20% were adequately sedated with just the initial loading doses, whereas almost all patients in the midazolam group needed a top-up dose.
So in practical terms, patients were sedated more quickly and were ready to leave sooner, which has clear implication for endoscopy practice and day-to-day capacity management. What about safety, Keith? Was there any concerns around safety?
So that there were no significant differences in adverse events, but there were provisional signals in terms of lower hypotension rates, lower rates of bradycardia in the remimazolam group. And this is quite surprising, considering that they were sedated at a deeper level.
So we are potentially gaining efficacy without compromising safety, and that's very important.
Correct.
And patient experience is also a very important aspect here, right? So Keith, what did the study report in terms of patient satisfaction?
I've always said that being awake during endoscopy is overrated. And patients are more likely to thank me for being asleep than being awake. Overall, patients on remimazolam were more likely to report a positive patient experience.
That's very interesting. The patient reported higher satisfaction, but that probably, as you highlighted, Keith, shows the fact that it's deeper sedation compared to the average sedation we used. How would do you think that this would impact both the quicker recovery and possibly a smoother sedation profile overall?
I think having a drug that allows patients to recover faster is great. Having a smoother sedation profile where patients have better comfort is also great and allows endoscopists to do a more thorough job.
Yeah, so taking this all together, how do you see that remimazolam will fit into our routine clinical practice in the coming years?
I think we're privileged to have this trial in our journal, and the data for remimazolam is really promising. But I have to heed caution here. I want to see more data in patients with comorbidity. Remimazolam doesn't rely on the liver for metabolism compared to midazolam, so it should be theoretically safer for patients with liver disease. So it might even be an advantage for procedures like ERCP or variceal bleeding related procedures. An important limitation here is that the patients here were all healthy. And also, patients didn't have fentanyl co-administration, which is pretty much my practice. There is a cost implication. In the UK, remimazolam is about 15 times more expensive, but this could be offset by faster turnaround times. For midazolam users like me, this study is quite eye-opening in a number of ways. Midazolam takes 3 minutes to start working and 6 minutes for maximum effect. So we need to give it time to work. The average dose of midazolam needed was 5 milligrams, but this ranged from 2 milligrams to 12 milligrams, which means that we might be giving insufficient amounts of sedation to our patients. And bringing this back whole circle to PUGIC, the first study we talked about, adequate sedation is really, really vital for high quality endoscopy. And this includes giving the right dose, giving it time to work, and perhaps even selecting the right sedative.
Wonderful. So this study really highlights how even small changes in sedation strategy can have a meaningful impact, right? And as the demand for endoscopy continues to grow, these kind of innovations could become indeed increasingly important.
Thank you very much, Keith, for this excellent overview of these articles. So let's wrap up today's episode. In this episode, we have explored how variation in endoscopic practice can influence cancer detection, how evolving resection technique can improve safety, and how innovation in sedation may enhance both efficacy and patient experience. Together, these studies highlight a common theme that incremental improvement in how we perform everyday endoscopy can translate into meaningful gains for patients. Thank you to our guest again for sharing his insight. And thank you all for listening. Stay tuned for more science from UEG Journal. Join us next time on UG General Podcast as we continue to bring you the latest and most impactful research in gastroenterology.